Hello there. Today is Tuesday, February 20th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, students across the U.S. angered by the latest mass shooting create an uprising aimed at lawmakers.
To every politician who is taking donations from the NRA, shame on you.
President Trump, though, indicating he's open to tougher background checks for gun owners. Dozens of men, women, and children are being slaughtered again in Syria. A new day in South Africa. Also ahead.
I have seen gods fly.
The movie Black Panther shattering box office records. It's all on today's International Edition. Nicholas Cruz, the 19-year-old man who police say has confessed to gunning down 14 students and three adults at the Parkland, Florida high school last week, was able to buy an assault-style AR-15 rifle to carry out the mayhem after clearing a background check. And in Washington on Monday, dozens of students laid down on the street outside the White House in protest, calling for tighter restrictions on gun sales.
In the wake of the school shooting, my friend Whitney and I decided that we wanted to do something about it. The politicians keep saying that they're sorry for the victims and their family, but they're not doing anything about it. And my friend Whitney and I believe that something needs to be done.
Survivors of last week's massacre are also planning a march on Washington and other U.S. cities next week or next month to demand tangible action from lawmakers to try to prevent future school shootings. Emma Gonzalez has become the face of a student revolt against lax U.S. gun laws after she condemned the politicians, including U.S. President Donald Trump, who have accepted campaign contributions from the National Rifle Association. She said the NRA is promoting a gun culture that leads to these horrors.
Divided by the number of gunshot victims in the United States in the 1.5 months in 2018 alone, that comes out to being $5,800. Is that how much these people are worth to you, Trump?
While funerals for the victims were taking place over the weekend in Florida, a major gun show opened in Florida's Miami area. 5,000 people were expected to attend, where visitors would be able to buy arms, including the kind that was used to gun down 17 people without a background check. Gonzalez says that they may be kids, but they understand what's at stake.
Despite being tipped off to the FBI multiple times, he was able to legally purchase an AR-15. He was able to legally purchase that semi-automatic rifle and come into my school and slaughter 17 of my people. Because of these gun laws, people that I know, people that I love have died, and I will never be able to see them again.
Well, joining us now to discuss more about this and what's happening here in the U.S., Professor Clive Williams with the law faculty at Australia National University. So before we talk about the issue of guns here and previously in Australia, what's the reaction there in your country? What are people saying?
Well, people just shake their head and say, you know, another one and no action from politicians. And it's just a regular occurrence, as you know. So I think nowadays people just shake their heads and say, only in America and move on.
This is something that was a problem in Australia at one time. But then after a mass shooting, something changed. How did that come about and how quickly did it change as far as gun violence goes?
There never had been that many major shooting incidents, but back in 1996, Martin Bryant used a weapon to kill 35 people in Tasmania at a remote location, and that caused horror in Australia, the number of deaths and the number of people wounded and so on. So the government of the day decided that they would initiate a gun buyback scheme and then tighten gun controls after that. So that's what they did, and that led to the handing in of about 660,000 weapons, and people were compensated for that. And then there was another gun buyback scheme in 2003 because there were a number of weapons that didn't get handed in for various reasons. So, and then since then there have been amnesties, so people could hand weapons in without penalty if they had them. You know, they were unauthorized to have them. So what happened was that gun deaths plummeted straight after that by about two-thirds. And now the gun deaths in Australia, usually around about 35 a year, something like that.
It wasn't ever something that was in Australia's constitution like it is in the U.S., was it?
There's never been the right to bear arms. I think that only occurs in the U.S. and Mexico and maybe Venezuela, I think. So there's only a very small number of countries that have the right to bear arms. But as I understand it, the original intention was that it was for people to be able to form a militia to deal with bad government if there was a bad government. But obviously that then became the right to actually own them, and have armories at home, which of course probably was never the intent in the first place.
I'm not sure they ever intended it to be used for military-style weapons either.
That's right. I think in those days when the Constitution was written, I doubt that there was much of a differentiation between military and non-military weapons. But of course, military weapons have become far more efficient. They've become automatic, far more accurate, far more deadly. So it's quite a difference to what it was back then, obviously.
It is unlikely in the U.S. that the Second Amendment will ever be overturned. But, you know, in lieu of that, what do you see that could make a difference in the number of murders and deaths that we're seeing due to guns here?
Well, I think, obviously, tighter controls on who gets guns would be one thing. And then tighter controls on where the guns are kept and, you know, not allowing people to build up private armories or buy huge quantities of ammunition might be other ways of controlling the problem. But, for example, in Australia, if I wanted to go and own a firearm, I would have to leave it at a gun club and it would be secured at a gun club. I wouldn't be allowed to have it at home. So if I was a farmer, it might be a bit different. I might be allowed to have a weapon actually at the farm because they might say, well, or you could say that you needed to control vermin, something like that. That would be acceptable for somebody to have a firearm at home if they were a farmer. But for somebody living in a city, having guns at home is wouldn't be permissible.
At the beginning of the interview, you know, you said people there just say, oh, yeah, another one. But do you think that this feels any different now with all the students rising up and really taking a stand and coming out? I mean, these kids are really, really passionate about this, and they don't seem like they're going to go away or stop fighting.
Well, it might be a grassroots movement that has, you know, started like others in America that actually do have an influence, because if they do start naming politicians who are taking money from the NRA and shame them and they lose votes as a result, that could have an impact. And I think, you know, I certainly hope it does, because clearly school massacres are an awful thing, and I can understand that young people are fired up about it because they're probably not gun-minded themselves. And I think maybe there is a change in the generations. One of the differences, it seemed to me, from having lived in America and lived in Australia, is that the attitude towards, for example, having guns and hunting. In Australia, if you said that my pastime is hunting, people would think you're a bit weird. You know, it's sort of not something that people sort of look sideways at you, thinking you had a mental problem. But, of course, in America, it's an accepted thing to be able to go out and do hunting and so on. So there's a different attitude towards killing, I think. And I think also in America, people tend to feel more threatened generally. Maybe that's justified, maybe not, I don't know. Because I notice that quite often when I'm in the US, you know, you see signs saying anyone that enters my property can expect to get shot or whatever. You can never see a sign like that in Australia. You know, it's a different attitude, I think. It's a bit, maybe a bit more aggressive among some sectors of the population. I think maybe there are more frustrated people in America because there's more of a divide between haves and have-nots, whereas, you know, it's a bit more blurred in Australia. So I think there are a number of factors there, social factors, that lend themselves to maybe differences in the number of gun deaths. Most of the gun deaths now would be either people using a weapon that they've got illicitly to kill themselves for suicide, or else it's criminals killing criminals because they can still get hold of guns. The only other guns that are in the public domain, the ones that are held by the police.
That's Professor Clive Williams with Australia National University. Meanwhile, the White House said Monday that President Trump supports efforts to tighten federal background checks on gun buyers in the aftermath of last week's school shooting. A surge in attacks by the Syrian government and its allies have killed dozens of people in the rebel pocket of eastern Ghouta near Damascus, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. The group also said airstrikes, rocket fire, and shelling on the besieged suburbs of Damascus wounded hundreds more. The British-based Syrian Observatory said the latest escalation started Sunday, leaving many civilians among the dead, including at least 18 children. UN Special Envoy to Syria, Stefan de Mistura, warned last week that the fighting in Syria is the worst he has seen in 4 years. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with University of San Francisco Middle East scholar Stephen Zunis.
Given how entrenched the rebels are and that this is an area that has long been in opposition to the government, there is likely to be fierce resistance and large numbers of casualties as a result. The Syrian government, of course, has made very little distinction between military and civilian targets when they've attempted to retake areas. And while we'll definitely see a tragic increase in the already high level of killing, this is not going to be something that is going to be over in a matter of days or weeks. Indeed, the carnage could continue for many months.
This area has been besieged now for nearly 5 years. Are these hardened rebels that are up against government forces, and will it be a tough fight?
It will be. In many ways, we're going to see a situation similar to Aleppo, unfortunately, where the government forces certainly had the upper hand in terms of weaponry, but they'll have to retake the area block by block. And the civilians, of course, not just those who are native of the area, but many of them are refugees from Aleppo and other places that the government forces have retaken. So there are a lot of people that are caught in the crossfire right now.
Is it really the government strategy to take over this district or just to pound it into submission?
Well, certainly their long-term goal is to retake control of the entire country, but they want to do so with minimal casualties. I mean, already the Syrian armed forces has lost many tens of thousands of fighters. That's why they've ended up relying on Hezbollah, other Iranian-backed militia and the like, not to mention, of course, Russian air power. So they're not in a hurry to take it back, but they certainly do want to end up trolling the entire country eventually. The question is how long it will take and how many more people will die.
Did Foreign Minister Lavrov tip his hand when he made these comments about likening Eastern Ghouta to Aleppo?
It's no secret that the Syrian government and their Russian allies are willing to engage in these kinds of heavy-handed tactics against entrenched guerrilla groups in urban areas. But for that matter, we saw the United States and its allies pound the western half of Mosul for many months, also with high civilian casualties. This is one of the tragedies of modern counter-guerrilla warfare. You see the opposition as terrorists, whether that's an appropriate label or not. The government forces that are trying to retake it believe that all means are necessary to take back control.
At the same time, Turkey is warning Damascus that it will confront its forces if they enter northwest Afrin province to help the Kurdish YPG militia, which the Turks have intervened to fight. Is this going to possibly widen the war, and why would they send that warning?
Well, the Kurds that have been under siege for some time are concerned that the United States appears to be backing off from their support and have been willing to make a temporary alliance with the Syrian government, despite many years of opposition, to protect them from advances by the Turkish forces, which have moved into Syrian territory. This does set up the very real possibility of a direct conflict between the armed forces of Syria and Turkey, which will add yet another complicated and potentially destabilizing dimension to this already tragic, confusing, and multi-sided war.
This at a time when Turkey, Iran, and Russia seem to be developing a rapprochement to try to end the war.
This may possibly be a kind of brinkmanship in order to force one side or the other to compromise and engage in serious negotiations to find some kind of peaceful settlement. But in any conflict of this nature, it's a pretty dangerous kind of brinkmanship, and it could very well end up into direct fighting.
Well, Syria's army, weakened by years of conflict, what would they hope to gain in confronting Turkey?
Well, legally speaking, Syria has a right to reclaim their territory, given that Turkey is violating their sovereignty by moving their forces into Syria. At the same time, given the array of forces that are against them, it would seem a questionable tactic to set up yet another front.
That's University of San Francisco Middle East scholar Stephen Zunis. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Trump revives a push for limits on immigrants bringing family. In India, Trump project buyers offer dinner with Trump Jr. A superstitious mob attacks BBC journalists in Malawi. After U.S. indictments, Russia denies election meddling. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, South Africa's opposition has harshly criticized new President Cyril Ramaphosa's first State of the Nation address, questioning whether the new president has a concrete plan to address the nation's many challenges. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
A day after taking office to replace the unpopular Jacob Zuma, President Cyril Ramaphosa's debut State of the Nation address on Friday outlined big ambitions and challenge South Africans to follow in the steps of their greatest leader.
Together, we are going to make history in our country. We have done it before. We have done it before, and we can do it again. Bonded by our common love for our country, our love for our people, resolute in our determination to overcome the challenges that lie ahead, and convinced that by working together we will build the fair and just, decent society to which Nelson Mandela dedicated his life.
Monday's parliament session offered the opposition an opportunity to criticize Ramaphosa's vision. The State of the Nation address is traditionally a roundup of almost every aspect of government work, and 40 speakers from the ruling African National Congress and the opposition debated the finer points for much longer than the original 90-minute speech. Ramaphosa's every position was dissected and questioned, from public safety to education to healthcare to the ANC's proposal to expropriate farmland without compensation. The main opposition Democratic Alliance challenged Ramaphosa's pledge to wipe out corruption after Zuma's 9-year run, which was riddled with corruption allegations. Critics of Zuma and the ANC have long maintained he did not act alone in allegedly squandering tens of millions of dollars in government funds. DA leader Musi Maimane challenged Ramaphosa to make good on his promises with concrete action.
But Mr. President, let me perhaps ask you by start removing ministers who have already shown themselves to be compromised. Show South Africa that you're really serious about fighting corruption in your party, and fire Batabile Dlamini, Faith Mutambi, Museveni Zwane, Melusi Gigaba, Des van Rooyen, David Mahlobo, Lynn Brown, and Mr. 7,000 rands per night, Bongani Bongo, out of your cabinet.
The opposition says Ramaphosa promised sweeping changes and more summits, conferences, and working groups than observers could count, but little in the way of specifics. That was not lost on the leader of the far-left economic freedom fighters, Julius Malema.
President, we are saying to you, you're doing all of this because you know that you'll be a president for 12 months. You are effectively saying to South Africa, there's nothing I can do in the next 12 months because I'll be looking for plans from commissions. And after 12 months, I will be gone.
The new president will have a chance to refute the criticisms on Tuesday. Ramaphosa has just more than a year to try to implement changes before next year's national polls. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Well, as the world watches the Olympic Winter Games in South Korea, some American athletes in Washington are lacing up their skates to train for their own major sporting event. Special in every way, these young people work to overcome developmental obstacles to compete for gold, just like the world's top athletes in South Korea. Arash Arabasadi reports from Washington, from Washington.
It's training day at the Fort DuPont Ice Arena in southeast Washington, D.C.
A lot of times if a kid has whatever the disability might be, they're really talented in other areas. So they never get that chance to have that exposure to another sport. And some of these kids are natural athletes.
These young people in skates are Special Olympics athletes. They compete in the world's largest sports organization for people with intellectual disabilities.
Some do not receive physical education classes, gym time, or the only time they get the chance to showcase their talent together is doing recreation. But here, we are a competitive, organized sport program that provides them with the opportunity that they may not get anyplace else.
These special needs athletes come from public and charter schools in the Washington area.
The goal of that is just to help them with their motor skills, help them feel more confident, help them introduce them to another sport. These kids are really just exposing themselves to something else and having fun at the same time.
Ice skating can be expensive, but through donations and their own nonprofit organization, everything from skates to coaches is free of charge to these competitors, leaving their focus on the ice.
You got to try something. You get on the ice, nobody's saying you got to be perfect. Just get the opportunity, make the best of your opportunity, and enjoy yourself.
It really installs that confidence and that idea that I might not be good at something, and that's okay. I just have to keep trying, and I'm going to get better at it.
These kids will compete in the Washington, D.C. chapter of the Special Olympics. Athletes just like them will do the same
good
in
job,
regional contests across the U.S. Gold medal winners at the Regional Speed Skating Championship will qualify for a lottery that could send them to national or international Special Olympics competitions. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Now for a look at some of the latest movie phenomenon to hit theaters. Lightning word of mouth stoked by glowing reviews, packed movie theaters with sold out shows, long lines, and fans decked out as characters from the film Black Panther.
I've seen men build weapons that I couldn't even imagine. I've seen aliens drop from the sky. But I have never seen anything like this.
The phenomenon of Black Panther had a record-setting debut weekend, and joining us now to talk more about it, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, I'm just amazed at how this has exploded. It's getting so much buzz.
There's just more than buzz. There's, you know, it's changing Hollywood. It's changing box office records. It's changing America. It's changing our culture. Black Panther is a nationwide phenomenon. Activists, churches, schools, they're buying thousands of tickets for underprivileged kids to see them in their cities. It just absolutely bring a note of African-American pride. It's absolutely amazing what this movie has done. And to set it up for you, Chadwick Boseman is T'Challa, who returns home to the kingdom of Wakanda to become king. And Wakanda is this fictional country in Central America that passes itself off as a third world country, but is actually a technologically advanced society that's hidden from the world in terms of its technology and weapons and culture to a special plant that's grown, and it's called vibranium. And this is what gives Black Panther his powers, and it also what makes the country thrive. Now, Michael B. Jordan plays Killmonger, who also makes a claim to the throne. And he comes accusing the country of Wakanda, saying, look, for centuries you've had this technology while you've let our brothers and sisters wallow in poverty and in civil war, and I'm here to change all that. We need to share this technology with the world. So the movie celebrates not only African-American culture, but it's a standalone Marvel movie, meaning that the entire movie takes place almost in Wakanda. And so it's just an amazing accomplishment for the film and for the African-American community. Now, being that it's a positive movie and an uplifting kind of cultural phenomenon, it is a movie. So I did have problems with some of the story because, like I said, most of the time we're in Wakanda. You know, in the beginning of the film, we have a nice London kind of action car chase scene with Andy Serkis, who plays this villain who's stealing the vibranium. Also, we have Martin Freeman, who plays one of the CIA agents. The movie also is kind of heavy-handed because it deals with racism, colonialism, slavery. There's even some white shaming in the movie, which I thought was kind of surprising. You know, so the movie portrays itself as isolationist, you know, but Black Panther wants to open it up to the world. So Ryan Coogler, who directed the film and also wrote it, he did Creed and Fruitvale Station. Amazing vision, you know, and Kendrick Lamar's music is phenomenal. So this movie is just, you know, even though I think it's kind of an average Marvel film, not the best superhero film that everyone's claiming.
Is the storyline actually new, or is it?
Well, no, it's from the 70s. It was a limited Marvel series in the 70s, and Wesley Snipes, you know, he's making the rounds saying he was trying to make Black Panther 10, 15 years ago. You know, so this was just the right time, and especially for Chadwick Boseman, the rumor has it he just didn't have the audition. They just called him up and offered him the role as the lead of the Black Panthers. He's going to see him again this summer in the Avengers in Infinity Gauntlet. I'm sure they're already planning another Black Panther movie, and they're fast-tracking it because this thing has just really gone crazy. Black Panther mania. And it's always with these Marvel films, stay through the credits because there's two what we call Easter eggs, two scenes during the credits and after that give you a preview of what's coming up in other Marvel films.
It's also really cool that there is an African-American superhero. We don't often hear about that.
I'm really happy to see that African-American kids have their own superhero to identify with. And there's also a backlash going on now because, you know, white kids are wearing the Black Panther masks and they want to go for a kid, you know, Black Panther is Halloween, and people are saying this is our culture and our heritage and they don't want to share. So it's opened a lot of interesting conversations and a lot of interesting articles on the internet. You know, the director is very, you know, adamant about saying it's for everybody. And just think about it. Captain America is not just for white kids. It's for all Americans. It's for all, you know, Superman. It's for truth, justice, the American way. It's for everybody. And he was making a point of saying, look, let's not separate ourselves with, you know, Black Panther's ours and not yours. He says it's all inclusive, and that's what superheroes are all about. But specifically, you're right. Now kids can look up and go, wow, African American kids can look up and say, that looks like me. That character I can identify with more than anything else, and good for them. It's about time.
That was Jeffrey K. Howard, and you can find more of his video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to supporting Afghanistan's government in its efforts to achieve peace, security, and prosperity for their country. As part of this support, we are working to undermine the Taliban and the Haqqani Network terrorist organizations. One of the best ways to hinder any terrorist group's activities is to disrupt the activities of its high-level operatives. To this end, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated under Executive Order 13224 four members of the Taliban and two from the Haqqani Network. Abdul Samad Sani is involved in financing the Taliban and procuring supplies for them. In recent years, he has on numerous occasions raised or collected funds for the Taliban, purchased supplies and ammunition for Taliban commanders and fighters engaged in combat in Afghanistan, and appointed special representatives to serve as Taliban fundraisers abroad. Abdul Qadir Bashir Abdul Basir, a member of the Taliban Finance Commission, has provided Taliban commanders with tens of thousands of dollars to fund their operations and disbursed funds directly to Taliban shadow governors. Hafiz Mohammed Popalzai is one of four individuals responsible for all Taliban financing, including foreign financing and money from the narcotics trade. He also invests the Taliban's money. Malawi Inayatullah has operated as the overall Taliban member responsible for attacks against Afghan and coalition forces in Kabul and provided financial support and other materials for the attack planners. Fakir Mohammed has for many years been a major fundraiser for the Haqqani Network. Gula Khan Hamidi facilitated communications between a Haqqani Network official and a Haqqani Network contact in Syria. He also facilitated the transfer of funds from the Haqqani Network to Haqqani-affiliated extremists. We are targeting six individuals related to the Taliban or Haqqani Network who have been involved in attacks on coalition troops, smuggling of individuals, or financing of these terrorist groups, said Sigal Mandelker, Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. This action supports the President's South Asia strategy by disrupting these terrorist organizations and publicly exposing individuals who facilitate their activities. The Pakistani government must work with us to deny the Taliban and the Haqqani Network sanctuary and to aggressively target their terrorist funding.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.